Hello and welcome to the TCR number 8 daily podcast, coming to you from the town of Terenz in the Austrian Alps. Our hotel is surrounded by mountains. It's got a very creepy collection of taxidermied animals, including a fox and some kind of ferret, which is a terrifying like welcome as you turn up in the nighttime. So that's kind of the first interesting hotel I'm going to tell you about, and I think it could get weirder from here on in. After the absolute chaos of the last episode we had, Karen's back to restore some much-needed calm and structure to proceedings. So welcome back, Karen.
Hi, nice to be back. That feels like a lot of pressure to impose some calm and structure, though. But I've been, I've been enjoying watching the chaos of the podcast and also the race from the sidelines.
Yeah, man. Well, the bar's not set very high after that last one, so you don't feel any pressure.
Whoa. I take exception.
And of course also you've already heard from him here, the man who sounds more like Cav than Cav, it's Rob Quirk.
I take exception to that too. I actually had to forward videos to my missus and ask her, do I sound like Cav? I don't know.
what did she think?
Absolutely not. She said he just sounds like a northerner.
Okay, well, we'll take the listeners' views on that. You know the email. let us know what you think. So, Karen, we haven't seen you for a while. Lots happened since we last spoke. The race has actually started. Quite a few riders have gone through CP1 already. How's it been to be back watching the TCR live again?
Yeah, it's great. Yeah, it's obviously exciting seeing what's unfolding at the pointier end of the race. But I'm just loving all the middle of the pack stuff on Instagram and all the pictures of food and poor routing and all of that stuff. That's what it's about for me. Everything, yeah, food and when stuff goes wrong. That's the best bit for me. Yeah,
good fun, isn't it? We'll get onto some of that good stuff later in the pod. We were talking about that big kind of north-south split as the riders headed east across Germany, trying to avoid those mountains in the middle. And it's quite interesting to see how that kind of panned out in the end as they approached control point one, and those two distinct groups started to merge together. And we could then see who was actually doing well and who was in the lead. So I've put a couple of screenshots from the tracker here, which show like at about 9 p.m. And then about 12 hours later when they'd merged, and as Ulrich and Robin were just about to hit the parkour. So I don't know if you can make out what's how that worked. Basically, it looked like Robin was quite far in the lead, didn't it? He was a lot further east, but then we knew that he had to drop down south quite a lot to get to the control.
I think in the end, you can see, even though everyone made these different routing decisions, that it seems to have all evened out in the end. Yeah. So, although some people, because if you do go on the clicker, if you do go on the tracker and you click on people's names, particularly if you look at the front group, if you click on Ulrich, the tracker says he's covered something like 1040 kilometers, but then if you click on Robin, I think it says he's covered over 1100 kilometers. So
yeah,
Robin's obviously done more miles, but they're virtually in the same place at the moment. So
yeah, exactly, just shows the two different approaches. We'll have a quick look at who went through control point one in what order. Do you guys want to just quickly run through that?
Yeah, can do. So I think first through the control point was Ulrich, who we think has been having some knee pain since about 500 kilometers in, so doing well, all things considered. And then closely followed by Robin, and if I've understood, they might have then met a bit later on the parkour, or they met on the parkour when Robin was on his way to the control point.
Yeah. It was quite cool actually, because Robin had a really interesting approach to getting to the control. So he arrived at the parkour quite a way into the parkour, basically at the top of a climb, rather than arriving at the start of the parkour, which you would kind of conventionally do, I suppose. Whereas Ulrich headed straight to the start of the parkour, and Robin did this descent to get to the start. And as he was descending, Ulrich had started the parkour and they kind of crossed over on that climb. And then Robin turned around at the bottom, started chasing Ulrich up the climb. So Ulrich knew that he had this guy. And it was only about, I don't know, a couple of minutes gap or something, 90 seconds behind him. So it was a real full-on chase going on up that climb to the control, which was pretty awesome.
I think it's worth pointing out that this control is halfway on the parkour. So for everyone listening at home, your parkours are mandatory sections that riders have to ride. So the rest of the route, they plan themselves a parkour they have to ride. And then I think, has it happened before? But to my knowledge, controls tended to be either at the start or the finish of a parkour. And in this instance, it seems quite unique that the control is halfway up the parkour. But also this parkour is it 100 kilometers long? 120 kilometers?
120?
Yeah, it's a long one.
Which is quite, I think, quite exceptional as well in the history of the race.
Yeah, it's an unusual control point, actually. You're right. Yeah, and which is providing us with some unusual approaches to it.
And potentially sowing a little confusion amongst some riders as well, which is an added bonus for a spectator. So thank you.
Yeah, we've heard about a few people just completely getting it wrong. In fact, even Robin got it wrong when he turned up. I still haven't quite worked out what he did, but he messed it up as well. So he potentially would have got to the control first if he'd have done it right. And then, yeah, third in was Ian Toe. And then there was actually a pack behind them following them pretty closely. So it was a very tight and competitive first control point, which is very, very exciting. And then what about the women?
So I think there are maybe four women have come through now. I think Megan made it through, and I think also Amre.
Yeah.
And then Christine Camara seems to be coming into the mix as well. So there's kind of a group of four women that are not that far from each other.
Brilliant. That's good to hear. It's good to know. We've got a good bunch of women riders, because it might make for exciting viewing later in the race when you start to hack it out. Obviously, Fiona's been a favourite for this race, having won the last edition of TCR, but she hasn't been without her problems today. I think a post has gone up now, but unfortunately through the night last night she had her bag stolen, so her purse and her tracker have gone missing. So for anyone at home wondering why she might not have moved, it's because she doesn't have her tracker now. So so unfortunate. I mean, she's been spending a lot of time doing police reports. She's somewhere near Plzeň, I think, in Czech Republic. I think she's on the move again now. She sorted that all out. And when she gets to control point two, so it'll be picking up a new tracker. But yeah, definitely a very unfortunate set of circumstances. But it does really go to show all the different things you have to, I don't know if you can prepare for that, but be ready in this race.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's pretty unusual, and it's really, really bad luck. And there's not too much you can do to mitigate against that. It's just, there's only so much that you can be kind of careful, and that can happen to you at any time, can't it? So really unlucky for her there, and it'd be interesting to see. Just looking forward to to seeing all that being sorted out, really, and seeing a dot back on the map. And then Pez through control point one.
So Theo and Stefan are definitely through and well on their way, as are the Gates family. But I think they're still, as we're talking, I think they're the only two pairs through. Yeah. But yeah, both with a strong start.
Continuing their battle. And we've had a few scratches, not too many, but do you want to go through the scratches as well?
Sure. So far, we've had, to my knowledge, four scratches. So Natalie Smith, Stefan Ty Fantala, Thomas Johnson, and Stefan Reich. And interestingly, one of the pairs have split. So Maxine Bisonnet has scratched, but her partner keeps on riding without her, which is, of course, is an option for pairs. They don't have to scratch together, but the finishing half of the pair will get a time, but not a classification. Is that the right terminology?
I have to check the classification because I've been looking into this morning and I need to have a proper refresher on it. But yeah, basically you can't finish as a solo finisher if you've been in a pair. So you can finish the race, but you won't be in the kind of classification. So you couldn't win it as a solo rider, having been in a pair, basically.
Because you've started off with the advantage of being able to draft with your pair, presumably.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. They're just kind of separate, completely separate classifications. There's no mixing between them.
Let me just drop in from the future to clear this up. So when one member of a pair scratches and the other one chooses to continue, the pair that continues will be out of classification. So they won't be in the pairs category any longer because they're not riding with their partner, and they can't move to the solo category because they have ridden with a partner previously. So that means that they can't be in either of the general classifications, and so they're moved out and they become a finisher. They can finish the race, but they won't be in either classification of the race. So in effect, they're kind of pulled out of the more serious side of the race, and they'll be a finisher with people who, for example, don't reach the control points in time, or maybe have committed some kind of error or breach that means they're pulled out of classification.
So, right, Karen, here we go. We can get into the fun bit now, the social media aspect of people's stories that are cropping up from the mid-pack. And, well, all throughout, actually, because the first one we want to talk about, which we touched on before, is Ulrich's knee. And he's put a lovely photo on Instagram, big close-up of his knee, where he's just prodding it in the area where he's getting some pain. And yeah, he's saying my knee causes pain on every pedal stroke since kilometer 500, and he's now 1290 kilometers in, probably more by now. It's hard to keep pushing, but even harder to stay positive, but I try to focus as good as I can. So interesting there, like, yeah, it really hurts, which is extremely challenging in itself, but then it's having a big effect on his morale as well. You know, it really gets you down, doesn't it? So he's trying to stay positive. Have you guys kind of had a flare up of an injury or a niggle during a race before? And what's your experience been of that?
Yeah, I mean, I'd imagine most people at some point over the 4,000 odd kilometres are going to have some kind of flare up. I guess it's difficult when it comes so soon in. You know, Ulrich's had that knee pain for over 50% of his distance covered so far, and I mean, he doesn't seem to be holding off much. He's still going at a pretty blistering pace. But it can be hard when it's kind of playing on your mind. I mean, I've had some hospital stopovers on ultras before, where I thought I was going to have to scratch. I thought I'd seriously torn my thigh muscle. I'd never felt anything like it. But they told me it was fine, and all I needed to do was just rest for a few days. So obviously I didn't do that, but I did kind of strap it up and just take it easy for a day or two. And it's kind of amazing how I think the body can sometimes just heal itself if you're a bit kind to it and try and ice and roll things as you go. But obviously it really depends what the issue is. I don't know, for example, if Ulrich, if that's kind of an existing thing that he knew about. What about you guys? Have you had any niggles?
Definitely, I think doing ultras, it's part and parcel, and it tends to be unavoidable to some extent. Obviously, things like making sure you ride a lot before the race so you can find out which parts might pose problems, but inevitably, when you're sat in the same position on the bike for 16, 18, I mean, some of these guys, I think Ulrich, last time I checked, had only stopped for 2.5 hours, 3 hours for the entire race so far. So 2.5 hours in nearly 48 hours, is that right? You're going to hurt. You're going to get niggled.
Yeah, he stopped for 5 hours and 1 minute in 2 days and 7 hours. Go. So
must have had a rest.
For someone who's got knee pain, he's not stopping very much.
So as you can, I mean, it's a repetitive motion you're doing on the bike. I mean, personally, I would tend to get shoulder pain as you get fatigued and tired, a lot more of your body weight ends up resting on your bones rather than your muscles. Instead of your muscles keeping your weight off the bike, you just start to slump as you get more and more tired. I mean, the other big one, which I haven't seen any posts on yet, is saddle sore, which is always one that tends to present itself on these events, because you might ride in a pair of shorts with a saddle every day for on a commute doing 20k, or on the weekend doing 100 or 200k, but then as soon as you do 1000k on it, you're like, oh my god, this is very uncomfortable. And I mean, I myself suffered from that. I had not the best shorts when I did TCR, that was agony, like absolutely agony. But I managed. Luckily, I cycled past an ASOS store in Switzerland and spent a lot of money on a pair of shorts. But as soon as I got back on the bike, my average speed went up 5 kilometers an hour. And that was just from a pair of shorts. So there's a lot of stuff that can be going on with the riders here.
We've got a question that's come in from James Vernon. It's about route planning. And James says, it would be great to hear in some detail about how people go about route planning, what tools they use, is there any use of paper maps and backups in case of device malfunction, and what roads are prohibited. So I don't know, what's your guys' approach to all of the above?
Do you want to kick us off, Rob?
Sure, yeah. So route planning transcontinental is painfully difficult, especially when you're trying to do it through France and Western Europe. It is just, you look at a map, it's a total maze of roads, and you have to try and educate yourself on which ones you're allowed to cycle on, which ones you're not. Of course, the race organizers also have prohibited roads, but they tend to be things like, when I did the edition, it tended to be a lot of roads when you got into Eastern Europe, because the map becomes less populated with roads. So there becomes clearer choices between which routes to take, But for instance, on the edition I did, you know, they banned, technically it was a motorway, you know, they banned it, which might sound obvious, but when you're on the ground, you wouldn't necessarily think it's a motorway straight away. And when you're actually on the ground, you get presented with this choice of either taking a very brutal gravel track or cycling through a very fast moving tunnel. I actually went through the tunnel and I took the time penalty because the gravel track just seemed way worse than fighting a motorway. But of course, yeah, I got half an hour deducted from my time for that. And that comes after the race when people start checking your route.
Or I guess technically that would be added to your time, right?
Yeah.
Otherwise, that would be a great tactic.
It's a great time penalty otherwise. Yeah.
Sorry, yeah, added to my time. But, I mean, in the end, after I did the race, I realized I should have just, when it came to route planning through France, should have just stuck to the main roads, which I think Strasser pointed out in his Instagram.
And everybody's planning their routes online, I'd have thought. I don't think there'd be anyone on TCR now planning a route on anything other than one of the tools that people use typically online, like Rider GPS or Komoot. And then that's being fed into a little GPS unit on the bike, so you can just watch that and follow your line, the route that you've pre-planned across the continent, which is a brilliant system and really, really practical. But if that goes wrong, which things tend to do on TCR, what do people do as a backup? Do people have a backup? Have you guys had a backup? And have you ever taken a paper map or had to get a paper map along the way to enable you to continue to navigate?
So I've always had a backup. I think the issue with TCR covering such a huge area is if you're bringing paper maps, you'd need like an entire trailer behind your bike to carry them all. Which is not very conducive to fast ultra racing. So I think paper maps are probably out of the equation unless you're stuck somewhere and you've got no other means and then you need to track down a shop. So I've typically, my backup has just been my phone, and there are different kind of apps you can get maps on. So like maps.me or just using Google Maps. There's a range of different stuff and that's been quite useful. Both as a backup map, but also if you can, having your route on that as well. So if your little GPS device breaks down, you can at least navigate from your phone. And I would imagine most people do have some kind of backup, because especially, you know, with some of the heats or the heavy rain that we've seen, it's pretty easy for devices to go wrong, malfunction, or potentially just run out of battery and you've not kind of got your charging cycle sorted properly. So yeah, definitely a backup is a good idea. Rob, what do you tend to ride with a backup?
Not really. And even though when I did Transcontinental, my Garmin died. So it rained so hard that my Garmin just died. It got waterlogged and I popped it in a bag of rice and hoped for the best. And then after that, I guess I was kind of lucky it died just before the Alps. And when you're cycling through mountains, there's only so many directions you can go because of the limited routes around a mountain and road signs. I mean, what did we all do before Google and phones? And it's like you follow the road signs. So I literally just followed the road signs and it was spot on. And if I got stuck, I'd pull my phone out just to double check. And then, when I was in the Balkans, same thing. It was very, very easy to navigate off road signs. And there's not many choices when it comes to routes. The only place where it was a huge problem was France, where you look at a map and you just like, it's like a spider's web of roads. Mm. So, yeah, I mean, best advice, just don't let your GPS break in France and you'd be fine.
But just quickly on that, Tom, I know you're getting shooed out of your hotel room any minute now, but I think on the topic of backups, I think one thing that I did also have, which is really useful and would be good if you end up needing to resort to the follow the road sign option, is I had like a really, really tiny book with me where I'd written down kind of all the major waypoints along the way. So I at least knew, you know, which towns I was planning to go through. So if you've got something like that, then yeah, reading the road signs is not a terrible plan.
Oh, extraordinarily organised, that. Love it.
Did you sellotape it to your stamp?
Did it pay off, though? Yeah. No, because I changed my route a million times.
I was going to say, that's the old Audax technique, isn't it? Sellotape it to your stem, and then that's your directions.
Yeah, I love it. Right, as Karen said, I'm about to get kicked out of this hotel room by a particularly scary Austrian hotel owner. So I think we're going to have to wrap that up for this episode, if that's all right, guys. But thanks so much for joining me again, and look forward to catching up as the riders start approaching CP2 and getting into some serious mountains. So thanks for coming back, Karen.
Cheers, Tom. Looking forward to coming back next time. Good luck with what the roads have in store for you today.
Yeah, who knows? And thanks, Rob, or should I say Cav?
Yeah, we'll see. Please, listeners, write in and tell us what you think. Do I sound like Cav? Do I sound like the Manx missile? I'm guessing you mean Mark Cavendish and not Lord Cavendish, but
yeah. Lovely stuff. And don't forget, you can send in those answers to Rob. To the normal email address, race@transcontinental.cc, with "Does Rob sound like the Manx missile" as the subject. And thanks for listening. Don't forget to subscribe, leave a rating and review, and we'll see you back here tomorrow or possibly the next day whenever we release the next one. Thank you. This podcast is supported by our race partners: Apidura, Physique, Hutchinson, Kinesis, Komoot, LEM Helmets, and Pedaled. All the music has been created for this series by Joe Skinner.